Ideas are what help shape our perspective, which ultimately orients our behavior. And so this is why it's so important, because like a person's life can be oriented toward greater good or greater bad based on the ideas and the perspectives and, you know, also the experiences, of course, but like how they see the world can determine how they act within the world, as we've been discussing. And if they see it one way, maybe they do more good in the world. And if they see it another way, maybe they do more bad. They hold themselves to a lower standard. They allow themselves to be dishonest or corrupt or like wanting to control other people.
Alrighty, everyone. Welcome to episode 72, which is part 3 of the Money Messiah series. And this one we're calling Theology and Mythology. And there's a quote in here which I really loved. Money is to markets as God or value is to consciousness. That was one of the mind-blowing pieces of this piece. Of course, if you haven't listened to part 1 or part 2, go back and check those out. The episodes are in chronological order right behind this one. And in this episode, we explore mythology and theology. We kind of explore this idea that myths emerged as narrative as a means to teach us a kind of meta, as Trav and I have discussed in the past, you know, a mode of being or a mode of operation. And kind of, you know, put the question is like, you know, pagan multivariant gods as a map, do they map to this idea of multiple personalities and multiple contexts, which you'll listen throughout the podcast that John and I discuss, versus this idea of like monotheistic gods as the highest truth or the greatest good or the absolute, which are both really powerful metaphors. And, you know, so it's something we really try and grapple with in this podcast. We talk about Nietzsche and the will to power. In fact, I'm going to do another podcast with Robert Malka coming up soon, where we'll dig further into Nietzsche's work. Now, I've been meaning to read a bit of his stuff, and I've had a chance to read some excerpts, but I've been super busy with conferences and all sorts of things. So I will want to probably do like a book series, and most likely with Rob Malka, to kind of explore some of Nietzsche's work. So stay tuned for that. We ask, who defines good, and is there such a thing as the greater good? We talk about God as being defined as the thing of highest value, or the thing of greatest truth, or the thing of highest good. We talk about morality, we talk about internal, external truths, and as I mentioned earlier, John has this beautiful segment in the article, which is this idea of the market is an aggregate of hierarchies, and hierarchies are an aggregate of values. And that's sort of where the saying money is to markets as God is to consciousness, money is to markets as value is to consciousness. That's sort of emerged from this discussion. So super, super cool discussion. This is the end of the initial 3 parts, and then John and I will record a part 4, 5, and 6, most likely, in the coming weeks. So stay tuned for those. My shill for value, once again, if you're listening on Spotify or Apple Podcasts or Google Play or any of those things, get the hell off there. Download Fountain, download Breeze, download Sphinx, download whichever one of these emergent podcasting 2.0 platforms are coming up, and come and interact with me. Ask me questions. Send me boosts. I'm going to start reading these out every single week. I'm going to start taking your feedback in. I'm going to start listening up to what you guys want. You know, I'm going to start going through and doing dissections or analysis on each of these pods. I really want to engage with you guys. Tell me who you want me to have on a future episode. Tell me what topics you want me to cover. Tell me who you think I should not just interview, but what sort of pointy questions you want me to ask people in future series. So there's all sorts of stuff we can do with the boosts. I'd love your support. I know the boys helping me put this together, Pled Music and Gettles, would love that shit too. We put a lot of work into making this stuff really cool. And as of 2022, I'm actually really going to double down, as by now you will have started hearing the Wake Up Reads coming out. We're going to do a whole lot of things. So once again, thank you for all your support. Jump on Value for Value. Enjoy this podcast. If you have a moment, also jump on uncommunist.com. By the time this pod's coming out, the book should almost be in Amazon. We're going to want a bunch of reviews. So it's not yet on Amazon, if you jump on uncommunist.com, you'll be able to get on the mailing list and really give us a boost so that we can hit the bestseller lists when it comes out, and hopefully really spread this and infect the minds that we want to infect in a good way. So I'll shut up now. I'll let you guys get into episode 72, Theology and Mythology with John Pallas. Mythology and theology. So I've got a note here which says that myths emerged as a means to teach us a meta or a mode of being or a mode of operation. So I guess I wonder how to tackle this section. Like, first of all, how do you differentiate between mythology and theology? First of all.
Well, again, I'm not super familiar with like the formal definitions of either. In my mind, it seems like theology might come with attached to it more prescriptive sort of behaviors, whereas mm-hmm. mythology, the behaviors are more implicitly communicated. But the easy answer is I don't think they're really in different realms. Mm-hmm, but mm-hmm. I mean, it's interesting. Again, this goes back to the idea of the cave paintings. It's like, why do certain myths or narratives emerge as stickier or more impactful than others? And I think it's because they are characterizing something about our internal and external situation and the meeting of the two in a higher fidelity way, in a more truthful way. And as a result, it resonates more. And as a result, you know, pursuing or emulating the actions there, and we have to be careful with that because they're not always meant for that, but to the extent that the values inherent in the actions of the mythology or theology can be ascertained and embodied and they lead to good outcomes, then it stands to reason that those would be more, you know, adaptively competitive and they would be retained, and the ones that are less so would be not, you know, not as strongly retained, or they would be down regulated to some degree. And so I don't think materially they're different enterprises, if that's mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. the question.
No, that's a really good answer. I think once again your piece about that which is prescriptive is a really good differentiating factor between the two, because I think they both stemmed and emerged for very similar reasons, which is once again trying to find a way to behave or orient navigate the territory.
And I think just one more point on that, like, I think yeah. if maybe I was blurring the lines a bit between religion and theology. Mm-hmm. You might just say theology is like the study of the notion of God rather than mm-hmm, like mm-hmm. any one particular religion. But again, I think they're intimately wrapped up, because the whole, you consult these powerful narratives, these powerful mythological narratives to try to gain insight into the workings of the individual and the collective and the cosmos ultimately. And so I think, you know, they go hand in hand basically, but the trouble is, you know, not falling for the many pitfalls of like overly literal interpretations and, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. corruptible systems of purveying this information, as we've been discussing. And, you know, the world seems to be a great example. The world today seems to be a great example of the many pitfalls inherent in pursuing the wisdom contained in those, well, the study of God or the various myths that have emerged throughout the years. The pitfalls entailed in doing so, because you know, here we are.
It reminds me, there's a model that, you know, an epiphany that hit me a while back, which I kind of, it actually happened when I was explaining to Paloma, actually. I asked her, I said, you know, what's your position on God? And she's kind of like on the journey, right? You know, probably where I was like 5-10 years ago about like, you know, thinking that, you know, God is just a silly idea, and it's, you know, particularly religion has been used as a way to suppress the human spirit, right, in some way, shape, or form. You know, and you know, I was taking her through that, and what I tried to do for her was separate the three things. It just came to me as a model. I was like, there's Christ or Christianity as the idea or the philosophy or the meta, you know, which is sort of like a pure teaching or a pure set of ideas about how to operate or orient as an individual. Then there is the second layer, which is the religion. And for me, a religion is an interpretation of the philosophy or the meta, right? So it's, you know, and there can be many religions of this core sort of idea, right? And if Christ is the central theme of the idea, or Christianity is the central theme of the idea, there can be, you know, Orthodox and Protestants and Catholics and all this sort of stuff. And what they do is they just have their own spin and interpretation. And even that is fine. And then kind of like the third layer, which is where I think the wheels fall off, and which is what we're squarely stuck in today in modern society, is the institutionalization of the religion, of the original philosophy, right? And that's kind of like, in a sense, it's completely fucking detached from the original essence of what Christianity was, right? Like, it's just become this attempt to effectively like take the map for the territory, right? Like, it's completely like flipped the fucking thing on its head. And instead of realizing that these ideas and, you know, concepts are a means through which we can navigate the territory, it's like said, no, the fucking map is the territory, and this is the way it is. And if you don't fucking do it like this, we'll burn you at the stake, we'll kill you, you're evil, you're a piece of shit, etc. And that breakup has really helped me get through to a bunch of people. Is like, look, separate the three. And yes, the institution is where the decay happens. And I've seemed to find that across all sorts of dimensions. Like, education is another one. You've got education, then you have schooling, which is the systemization of education, and then you have modern indoctrination fucking camps, which is the degradation of the, you know, the systemization of education. So it's a step removed, and I feel like that's in so many places. So I wonder, I guess there's a question here. I wonder what your thoughts are on that as like a mental model to use. Number one. And number two is, where does theology fit in that? Is theology, you know, sort of like first layer, or is there another layer there? I don't know.
Yeah, I think it's a great framework to shake people out of the notion that it's silly to assume there's a guy in the sky, as we said earlier. I think it's very helpful. I mean, this whole conversation could be under the rubric of theology, right? We're asking the question, what is the thing of highest value, and how best to orient ourselves around it? I mean, call the highest value is a synonym for God, in my opinion. And so we're engaging in it now. And so I think, to answer the question, like, where does theology fit? It fits squarely under the paramount responsibility of each individual. That's where it fits. Perhaps nothing is of greater import. I mean, it's almost like tautological, if I'm using that word correctly. Like, if we're assuming it's the highest value, then your primary orientation. Not to say that they're at the exclusion of other important things, but it should be what forms the basis of the hierarchy that determines behavior. So if you're going to be, for lack of a better term, an optimized human being in the world, then I think the most important endeavor that you have to contend with is, what is the thing of greatest value, and how do I best orient myself around that? And then do all the things, figure out how to do what we've been trying to figure out in this conversation, is that how do you distill them into action in the world such that who you are, what you embody, and what you create is optimized for, you know, transmuting that value or that highest value into the world, into the physical world. That's where I think it fits. And, you know, I wanted to reflect on what you were saying. And I, like, obviously we're both critical of religious institutions and all that kind of stuff. But if we're going with the reasoning that we've been using, like, we have to at least account, like, give the devil its due a little bit in saying, if they were so, like, we don't, how could we possibly know that anything could have been any different than how it's turned out?
Mm.
Maybe this was the best we could have gotten, because absent the religious institutions, maybe we would have fucking killed more of ourselves more harshly and more horrendously and all that kind of stuff. So, like, I think we should strive to transcend them, the institutions that have led to, you know, destruction in the world and hate and violence and bad outcomes, generally speaking. But it might be the case that, you know, we are where we are for a specific reason. And, like, we talk about the free market a lot in, like, Bitcoin land and economic circles and stuff. And of course we all say, well, there's no fucking free market anywhere in the world today, you know, like, maybe Hong Kong or, you know, places like that are the closest approximation, but still not even close. And I agree with that, you know, economically and market speaking, but reality is the ultimate free market, right? And there's no saying that it's not operating, because that's the only way that it operates. And so why is it that a certain idea or a certain institution or a certain person attain the power to impose their will or their way of thinking or their ideology or their belief system upon others and impose? I don't even, like, in most instances mean, like, by coercion or force, but by the strength of the idea itself and by how people internalize it and in, like, kind of inject it into their perspective and willingly subordinate themselves to it. And this is why, like, you know, we keep talking about this idea of subordinating yourself to the highest values. This is why it's such a high stakes game, because if you don't do, like, and why we should be having these conversations and why they shouldn't be so easily dismissed by the culture, because if you subordinate yourself to the wrong thing, like, you sacrifice to the wrong thing, as we've been saying, you could bring about a lot of bad, right? And that's why it's so important to make sure your orientation is as true as possible, as the map is most closely cohering to what is really the ultimate territory. And, you know, a very perhaps overly simplified example of this is, like, if you take the state as God and you orient yourself around its dictates, and you, like, that is the thing that you most kind of use to develop your perspective and use as an authority and all that kind of stuff, we're in the middle of seeing what happens if that is if that prevails. Mm-hmm. And so reality is a free market. And the reason why it's so important to, for each person to be a theologian, let's say, is because reality goes to fucking shit if you're not sacrificing yourself or subordinating yourself or orienting yourself to what is most true.
Couple threads I want to pull there. The piece that you were talking about was these things won out for a reason, and arguably that reason is because they're either more correct or more adaptable or whatever. But I haven't read any of these books yet, but I've downloaded a whole bunch of books around, like, the Gnostics and around, like, looking at why Christianity emerged and why it won around the time that it won. And I think some of the arguments might center around the fact that the Roman Empire existed at the time. And, you know, maybe people are going to want to crucify me for saying this. But maybe it won out by virtue of the fact that this empire existed, and somehow the thought or the religious element was co-opted and brought into a center of previously existing power. And, you know, maybe it's not the ideal meta. And I'm playing total devil's advocate here. So I wonder if you've got a comment on that.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I don't think anyone can speak to the exact process that unfolded there. It's too multivariate to really nail down. But I think maybe to prove the point, we can make a statement that is entirely inarguable. And that is that any civilization that the Romans jacked up and basically destroyed and erased them from history, their fucking religion certainly didn't survive, right? Mm-hmm. So there's a survivability bias that comes with being attached with the dominant power network, let's call it. Mm-hmm. And I can't speak to why all the reasons why that ultimately became Christianity in like 300 or so when Constantine adopted it for the official religion of the Roman Empire, I think it was. And prior to that, it was like a more, you know, mythological or pagan or sort of arrangement, the typical Roman or Greek gods. Who knows? Like maybe the monotheistic aspect of having, you know, it clear what's at the top of the hierarchy, it, you know, and have it more elucidated and articulated and idea, you know, the idea is more fleshed out, resonated with people more. And that's why it caught on. I mean, like at the end of the day, as we were saying before, culture is simply the manifestation of our collective minds being like turned inside out onto the world. But the other thing that you bring up with the Romans, and this always plays, and it plays in discussions about Bitcoin and proof of work and hash power and energy and stuff, is like power, like what is power? Mm. You know, that because power plays, like an idea can be extremely powerful, of course. And the reason ideas are what help shape our perspective, which ultimately orients our behavior. And so this is why it's so important, because like a person's life can be oriented toward greater good or greater bad based on the ideas and the perspectives and, you know, also the experiences, of course, but like how they see the world can determine how they act within the world, as we've been discussing. And if they see it one way, maybe they do more good in the world. And if they see it another way, maybe they do more bad. They hold themselves to a lower standard. They allow themselves to be dishonest or corrupt or like wanting to control other people. And, you know, obviously history is littered with just how, well, you might say that like the worst aspects of ourselves, but it's really hard to say that if we're running with the idea that reality is a free market. And like, you know, the fact that I'm sure, you know, many of the tribes and peoples that Alexander conquered weren't super stoked about it. Mm-hmm. Right. So he would have been evil to them, just like, you know, the US bombing Afghanistan. Of course, the Afghanistanis and the Iraqis are going to consider the US, or at least some of them will consider the US evil, you know, like, so it's a matter of perspective. Like, is power good or bad, or is the ability to enforce your will on the world, how much does that determine the course of history? And you know, we make a lot of noise in the Bitcoin space basically by saying a lot, and that's why Bitcoin's so exciting, because it removes the incentives to violence, right? It hopefully, it seems like it might downregulate the degree to which, you know, pure power or pure violence is incentivized as a means to push your will through the world or impose your will on the world, because you can't so easily confiscate people's wealth. And so, you know, the incentive to just kill them and take what they have is less, and, you know, all the analysis that we typically levy on that. But it is like the concept of power itself is one that I chew on a lot, because, you know, if we've been talking about this like nirvana state, the Godhead, that kind of thing. Where does power fit into that dynamic? And, you know, we touched on it a little bit, because we were saying like, you want the capacity to impose your will if needed, like the wolf example, right? Like if it's me or the wolves, I want to make sure it's the wolves, right? And maybe that's like a virtuous use of something like power and violence. But by virtue of the fact that we have that capacity, it matters how we deploy it. In that example, maybe it's righteous. Maybe that's why we have such a word. But when it's like me just jacking someone because they have bread and I want it, and I have 100 loaves of bread at home, that's maybe not righteous, and that's an improper use of that capacity. So I don't know. What do you think about that? Because I'm kind of drawing a blank on it.
Yeah, fuck. Have you read any of Nietzsche's stuff or no?
I read Beyond Good and Evil when I was like 20, so effectively no.
No, okay, yeah.
I've read him in parts, like excerpts and stuff, but
yeah, I've read a few excerpts recently, and it's honestly been challenging. So you know,
part of it is the, you know, the type of English used or the type of language and stuff like that. So I have on my to-do list amongst the million fucking bazillion other books that, you know, you want to get to, that I do want to read some Nietzsche before I can properly comment, because, you know, he talks about obviously this idea of the will to power, and that as the he almost, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, at least from the anecdotal stuff that I've understood and read and, you know, from third party sources heard, that he kind of views that as the highest ordering function of, like, we orient ourselves towards power. But his understanding of power seems to be far broader than, you know, what people think of as power. It's like, you know, the will to power means that we all just want power over others. And I think his view on power is more nuanced. It's, you know, the power is something to do with, like, ability or capability or competence almost. And in that sense, like, if competence is sort of the right word, you know, functional hierarchies are what? They're hierarchies of competence, right? So maybe it has something to do with, you know, this the sort of the greater good that we've been discussing. So I don't know. I hesitate to make a claim on that until I've, you know, read more of Nietzsche's stuff, particularly the power component, because you know, one excerpt that seems to come to mind is where he talks about, like, the highest and best men are those who don't delude themselves into thinking that the greatest moral pursuit or the greatest pursuit is that of power. You know, he says the realest, most authentic people are those who do recognize it and move towards that. But again, I'm probably butchering his stuff. You know, a good person to talk to about this is Rob Malka, who I need to fucking talk to again, because there's a bunch of stuff there.
I think a couple of things that come to mind. One, we talked about, like, methods of liberation, achieving liberation, or, like, the process or the mechanics of that before, and that's uniting with the highest value. I mean, it may be the case that, like, power, at least, you know, the negative form that we mentioned, is, like, the attempt to like, do that in the opposite direction, to achieve liberation, right? I'm the most powerful motherfucker, like, nobody can fuck with me, and, like, I have, but like, in the opposite direction of the Nirvana way of liberation, you know. And so and maybe you could make a case, and we wouldn't know if, like, we've surveyed people that devoted, you know, surveyed a bunch of people through history, but, like, which one is really happier? Is the martyr who died for his principles, I mean, is he worse off than the guy who rode into his town and killed everybody? Like, you would say, well, he lost in the power battle. Well, yes, you know, if he adhered to his principles throughout, and if the you know, the tyrant did not, first of all, even while living, who is more satisfied, who is more integrated with being itself? And maybe you would say that the former is, but also maybe this is why the notion of what our deeds are in life, you know, echo in eternity or the afterlife or something like that. And who am I to say that there's not some element of an interpretation of truth to that? But maybe it's because, you know, a recognition of this dynamic that plays out. And to the other point was just that I think to the imbalances of power are optimally mitigated through aligned incentives, right? So, like, I may be way more rich and powerful and forceful and have a bigger army than the next dude, but if our incentives are aligned, so in that case, perhaps, like, hypothetically, he gains nothing from jacking me, but we gain a bunch by cooperating towards some end, then that, you know, maybe you mitigate imbalances of power that way. And of course, again, you know, that's why many of us are so excited about Bitcoin, for its ability to create a network where incentives are so aligned, and the incentives to violence and imbalances and the expressions of imbalances of power are largely mitigated, at least in a certain, let's say, the economic realm. But yeah, I mean,
that's
all I got right now.
That's a tough one. So I want to come back to power down the track when we're both a little bit more versed, but something came to mind earlier when we were talking about the pagan god. So I want to hit the hero archetype really quickly after that, and then
right before you do that, though, I think the what I wanted to say as part of that aligned incentives piece, like, I think that is part of the role of religion. It's saying like, mm-hmm. let's align around this highest value, and let's determine what the highest value is so that we increase the likelihood that people will rationally align themselves around it. And if we all mutually do that, the imbalances of power, to the extent that we have misaligned incentives further down the hierarchy, the imbalances of power will be less problematic on those levels if the top thing were aligned around. And perhaps that's the point of determining the highest value in the religions that stem up around them. You know, maybe that's a component of it, but sorry to interrupt.
Yeah, no. I mean, that actually threads nicely into what I was going to pull up, is about this, the pagan world versus the monotheistic world. And, you know, I can see so much value in both. Is that what you just mentioned there is a benefit of a monotheistic frame of reference, which is a highest good or a highest fidelity or a highest truth. But what we're saying earlier was that, you know, maybe the apex experience is like bringing the appropriate values hierarchy to the appropriate, piece of the terrain. So, you know, the right map for the right terrain. And this is what very, you know, reminds me of Persig as well. Like, he's got that analogy in Lilo where he says, you know, this kind of map helps you here, but in the Arctic Circle, it's like a different kind of map. And, you know, they're both maps, but, you know, which one is more valid depends on the context again, which is what we discussed earlier. And, you know, wonder if one could argue that, like, the pagan structure of like multi-theistic gods was a way that pre-monotheism we were trying to imbue values hierarchies in archetype gods as a way to, you know, understand ourselves. And I wonder, you know, maybe it's the wrong question, like, which is more correct? You know, I don't fucking know. And I think it's possible to know, but like, I wonder what a world looks like on, you know, on a monotheistic standard versus a multi-theistic standard, polytheistic, whatever it's called, because they both seem to have, you know, relevance. And I wonder if there's a version where they, you know, they both coexist. You know, I don't know. What's your thoughts on that as like a little idea?
I think I'm pretty sure that Neumann, that's part of the case he makes, and maybe I've heard Peterson and others kind of frame it that way before, that because not like nothing that shows up in culture, I mean, it all came from here, right? So mm-hmm. it's all like it's mm-hmm. all any idea we have, any concept, anything, it's generated in here. So it's like it's orienting us and influencing us in that way. And then it takes on a representation. And I think we're somewhat foolish to think that the representation is somehow separate from us and it's like governing us. It is us. We came up with it, you know? And so to that extent, I think those polytheistic systems of faith or cultures or whatever, like, yeah, like different gods for different aspects of ourselves or different, you know, what people behave like when their orientation is primarily devoted to fill in the blank value, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, rage, mm-hmm, violence, mm-hmm. power, love. And this is the case, right? You have Cupid and Dionysus and Mars, and like, it's, of course, it's all just aspects of ourself, and we're able to see what they look like when they're exclusively those things. Mm-hmm. And typically it's not very good, right? Like you would, and that's why like the Supreme God is the supreme mm-hmm. god oftentimes, because it's the proper mix of all the different yeah. capacities that we have, right? To your question about like, could that form the basis of a makeup in the future or something like that? I mean, I think something is always at the top of any particular value hierarchy, whether we're talking about like menial ones or like the ultimate ones, mm-hmm. because, you know, that the whole consciousness functions through that comparative process of mm-hmm. determining mm-hmm. this versus that. And that's why I think that's what my comment earlier about like how that's both the mechanics, but also how we derive the thing that we should be striving for, is because the mechanics of consciousness almost produces it over time. And this is the whole process of culture, is like building upon the insights that we've generated in each successive generation to try to gain more clarity around what should be the most proper aim, you know, for us as individuals and for us as a culture. So we shall see, but I don't know if this conversation is any judge, or maybe that's not a good way to frame it, but I think
we're all lost.
Yeah, exactly. Who knows? But I think we'll always represent as much as ourselves as possible in the external interpersonal world. And then, just as it has always been the case, those representations will inform us how they should be reflected or retransmuted back into ourselves based on how we see them playing out in the culture or in our representations. And we shall see. I think that's all I got on that one.
Yeah. Well, what you're describing there reminds me of actually something that you mentioned in the article, which for me was really profound. Profound in the sense that it's just really concisely put, is that the market is an aggregate of hierarchies, and hierarchies are kind of like aggregates of value. And, you know, you have this kind of fractal relationship between them. And I thought that's beautiful. And I guess that's related to what you said about, like, you know, there's a market of gods, you know, in the polytheistic framework, that that, you know, maybe there is an integration of all of their psyches or archetypes or values hierarchies that does represent this this higher order, you know, the thing of highest value, the thing of greatest truth, which is, yeah, it seems to always wind up there anyway, which, yeah, that's interesting. Like, I mean, one of the questions I had here, which was part of this little, I took some notes around it, is you talked about the greater good in your article. You mentioned the greater good. And the question that I wanted to ask you is, like, what is your definition of the greater good? Like, who defines that? And I feel like I know where you're going to go with this anyway, but let me throw it in your court, because I think it's related to both of the things we're discussing.
Sure. to the last point, I think the analogy I make, first of all, I just think it's inevitable that we're going to externalize everything through the mechanics of our consciousness. And so, like, oh, you see hierarchies everywhere, do you? And you see value bubbling up in every different domain, do you? Like, well, yeah, it's because that's how our fucking consciousness works, right? So why wouldn't we expect to see it that way? And like, we, you know, we build the world as a reflection of ourselves, perhaps unavoidably. And I think, you know, the analogy that I was making to money and markets and consciousness and God, basically, is that money is to markets what value is to consciousness. And so it's both the mechanism for discovering greater value, and it's also the highest value itself, right? And so, like, the capacity for consciousness to pursue value and to pursue the highest value is what allows all of the action to flow from it. And the capacity for a market to have a mechanism for comparing value, and then also that very mechanism be the very thing that everyone in the market is trying to move closer or obtain more of, is the very thing that makes the market function itself. And so, again, like, why would we not expect the same mechanics if we're dealing in value? Like, the same mechanics of value that operate in our consciousness, we've transposed them into the material world in money and markets, it seems to me.
Can you say that again? Money is to markets as
value is to consciousness.
Value is to consciousness.
Or like, so you could say God is to consciousness, because we've been using them interchangeably. And I think, but, like, you know, God, let's say, is the ultimate value, and then all subordinate values are stepping stones toward that in some sense and require the ultimate value for their existence.
Dude, that's such a, if anyone's listening to that shit, clip that. Holy fuck, that was it's such a soundbite. Money is to markets as, you know, God value is to consciousness.
Can't remember the, what was the other question? Oh, it was like, I think in the piece I said, like, somewhere down the line you have to, there has to be an article of faith of some kind. And that is that, like, if what we're dealing with is saying that, like, we're trying to, both in our consciousness, we're trying to ascertain clarity as to what is most valuable, what is most true. And then in markets, we're also, the emergent process is the determination of what is most valuable. And it creates a hierarchy in itself, and it's trying to determine what is most true in the realm of value. Then I feel like there's a necessary phase somewhere down the line where you have to say, well, do you believe that what is most true is good? And I think if, like, anyone listening to this conversation would answer that question for us and say, yes, like, based on what I've been hearing these two dudes talk about, they believe that reality is somehow constituted on the good. We've been saying, like, we've been speculating, like, what if the fundamental substrate is value itself, or is love itself, or is God itself? Like, we've been using language that would seem to hint that we do believe that, like, what is most true is good, and therefore it is a valid and the most valid aim to pursue it to the extent that we can. And that's, you know, I just kind of say that in passing in the piece, because I think it's maybe necessary to add that in. And maybe that's part of the role of faith. Like, it's not something that maybe you'll ever be able to definitively prove, even though, like we've been saying, like, the outcome of embodying these highest principles that we would say are kind of all mixed up in God, like, it seems to be the outcome of embodying them is positive and good, both for the individual and the collective. But that may be the only proof you're ever going to get. So maybe there's an element of faith in saying, like, I think creation, the fact that anything exists at all, and the fact that we're here to experience it, and we can use these words and have these emotions and have these sensations and experiences, leaning towards it's more good than bad, I suppose.
Yes. To put my devil's advocate hat on again, and to piss you off with it, the one could argue that we're simply, how do I put this, like, let me maybe rephrase this. It's like, I think we have to be careful not to fall down the utilitarian trap of assuming that which is good is always of highest use. And I don't know if I'm butchering this, because, like, Jimmy Song and I were discussing this, was I was making the case, like, he and I did a podcast fucking 2 years ago now, about, it was called Bitcoin Bridges. And we were kind of looking at Bitcoin through a theistic lens, through a Christian lens. And, you know, Jimmy kind of said, look, you know, you're making a very utilitarian case for morality. And what I told him, I said, well, you know, not really, because I think utility is too multivariate. Like, what is useful for me is not useful, may not be useful for you, etc. And, like, utilitarian for me, like, sits in the realm of, like, empirical and, you know, science and all that sort of stuff. Whereas, you know, morality kind of sits more in this realm of good and theology and why and what matters, and, you know, that sort of more value realm. And I guess what I'm trying to say here is, I guess we just need to be careful of ascribing maybe pure utility to good and right and true, because sometimes they're not so useful, I guess, depending on the game you're playing. It's a sticky thing to talk about, because I don't know exactly how to articulate it, but do you kind of get the gist of what I'm trying to say?
I think I do, yeah. And I think I agree with it on like on all practical levels. But if we're talking about like the, if we're having a theological discussion, it's almost like, well, again, I mean, if we think that the substrate of reality is most fundamentally value or God or love, then what is most true is most that. And what is most that, or conforming to what is most that, then by definition elicits the best outcomes. Now, don't ask me, like, who can interpret the mind of God, basically, right? So who know, like, I could see it, I could easily poke holes in that myself in like all these different instances, because, but one can never be, obviously can never be sure that they're, you know, perfectly cohering to what is true, as well as is what is true what is most good. You know, these are axioms, if you want to like use that, but they're very difficult ones to act upon. And I think, you know, maybe it's, this is the point of this, the point of the discussion where we say, like, if determining like easy and clear answers to all of these like big questions was not only easy, but like even possibly definitive, whole fucking show of life wouldn't be happening, because like it would all be figured out, right? I think like that's the beauty of the messiness of reality, of the reality free market, is that all of this gets to play out, and we are participating in creation with whatever grander force is allowing us to do that. We're the ones that create in this world. I engage with you, I engage with other people, and we create experiences together. We generate emotions together. We build companies and arts and conversations and all this together. Like, we are participating in creation while we're trying to figure out the best way to do so. Again, we have that like sort of recursive feedback loop. And so this is what, you know, that's, I guess that's all I got for that one. But it's, I think with a fresher mind, I'd like to chew on that one again. I'm just kind of.
Yeah. I'd love to.
And mushy now.
I'd love to. So one question, and then I'll hit you with the last piece for this segment. And then we'll pick up another time. But what do you say to a person who says, look, there is no truth, there is no objectivity, everything is relative, or, you know, all truth is relative, like, you know, basically a moral relativist? What do you say to someone who's taken that stance and just believes that nothing really has, you know, overarching meaning, because it's impossible, because don't you know that Albert Einstein figured out relativity, and that therefore everything must be relative?
Well, that's certainly a perspective that permeates, obviously, a lot of the world today. And a lot of this discussion has been challenging that perspective, right? That there is something there is an absolute value, perhaps, and the ways in which it manifests in the world are evident if you know how to look at them or look for them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm not a very judgmental person, so I don't have much advice to give to anybody, really, like good or bad. But I would observe their behavior to try to see if their words cohere with their actions. And I suspect they would not. I suspect their actions would reveal certain values that are not relativistically determined, perhaps. And then I would know them better, right? You know, through our actions. You know, actions speak louder than words, right? Like, I mean, talk is cheap. I guess my have fun staying poor, like, sign off would just be cool. Like, let's see how that works out for you. Let's see what kind of life that perspective delivers to you. And, you know, I hope it delivers the best one it possibly can. But it's seeming more and more apparent to me that that is not the route to take for the most fulfilling, joy-filled, peaceful, liberated, love-filled, you know, all those things, life. So I guess, you know, we'll see in the end, you know, maybe if there is something afterwards where you know, you're judged in some capacity, maybe you find out then, I don't know, but.
That's a good way to wrap it up. I mean, I always have trouble with that because, I don't know, maybe I'll wrap it up with one final thought is that, you know, going through the Persig's MOQ now, like the metaphysics of quality, and you know, he dances on that line of maybe not relative value, but maybe contextual value, which I think is different a little bit to relative value. Because I mean, I guess you can't, you know, relativity in some sense is inescapable because, you know, we're always, as you said, like the value is always like being related to something else. But, you know, it's a, I don't know, I guess my brain is at a point that it's fried as well, but like it's a tough one to chew on, and one that I'd love to chew on in the next episode is like how to differentiate between the usefulness of relative value and the complete degeneration of all value when everything becomes relative. And yep. And that spectrum seems to be a tricky one. And I don't know, I guess I'm sure someone has tackled it, but I wonder if we can, along discovering the meaning of life in this podcast, discover how to better ascribe value in the world as sovereign individuals. So anyway.
Yeah. No, so a few seconds ago, you framed that up super nicely. And when I'd like to chew on that and discuss it again when we're both fresh. So let's actually do that, because I think it would be interesting.
Absolutely. Which part, so I can write down a note? Was it the?
Well, I mean, you'll listen contextual? To it. It was the, you know, the what you just were saying about relative value and you know, we'll I'm drawing blanks right now, but I think it is a worthwhile one to try to attack with fresher minds.
Amazing. All right, brother. Is there any final words for this segment before we wrap the sucker up?
No, man, just thank you. You know, I love these conversations and they help me refine my thinking, and I think they're extremely valuable, and you know, the proof is in the pudding, and I continue to pursue these sorts of conversations because like the more I refine this perspective around truth, value, you know, who knows what we're really doing here, but it seems to manifest itself in like visceral or palpable benefit in inside, you know, in whatever's going on inside. And so I, you know, anyone who helps me do that, I appreciate tremendously. And you know, I love you. So that's always good, bro. To jam.
Thank you so much. It means a lot. And yes, this was definitely one of my favorite discussions. And yeah, I always love a discussion where it's not just, oh yeah, man, let's go over what you wrote, but kind of ask some questions. And I think we actually
want to go further, man. You know, we don't just want to recapitulate what's already been said. You know, we want to break new ground if possible.
Absolutely. All right, brother. Thank you.
Yeah. Talk soon.